to have you back for another episode of MFA Writers. If you haven't checked out the special premiere episode of Season 4 with Ross Gay, I encourage you to do that as soon as you get a chance. Today we're back to our regularly scheduled programming, and I'm super excited to share an interview with Jess Silva, a recent graduate of Vanderbilt's MFA program. We've had several requests for an episode covering this program from listeners such as Rajiv Thiend, Amy Peltz, Sebastian, and Frank Turner, so I hope you all enjoy it and find it super informative. You can find MFA Writers on Instagram and Twitter, as well as mfawriters.com. We love to hear from listeners, so feel free to shoot us a direct message on one of those platforms or an email at mfawriterspodcast@gmail.com. And if you have a minute to rate or review the show, the best place to do that is on Apple Podcasts. Doing so will help boost our podcast as we try to boost these amazing writers. Also, if you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, you can apply at mfawriters.com. On that same website, you can also click the support button to support us financially, if it's within your means. Or you can do so by going directly to buymeacoffee.com/mfawriters. Finally, as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to MFA Writers, the podcast where we talk to creative writing MFA students about their program, their process, and a piece they're working on. I'm your host, Jared McCormick. Today I'm with Jess Silva. Jess is a third-year fiction MFA student at Vanderbilt University whose first novel, The Story of a Tight-Knit Immigrant Community Rattled by the War on Drugs, goes on submission this fall. Originally from New York City, Jess graduated from Columbia University with a bachelor's in psychology. They serve as president of the Disabled and Deaf Writers Caucus, and they help run the MFA Draft Facebook group, which, if you don't know, is a fantastic resource for MFA applicants. Today, Jess has brought a short prose piece to read for us titled Pests.
Pests. 1. Your family doesn't talk about the filth, not anymore. When you and your friends were children, you could joke about it on the playground. At Rose's sleepover, a mouse ran out from under the fridge and into your blankets, and Zainab stomped around like King Kong yelling, "This ain't Chuck E. Cheese, motherfucker." 2. Your grandfather was a clean man. He mopped the floor on his hands and knees and whitened the grout with toothbrushes and bleach. Military precision, he said, was something he learned when the mainland drafted him. He ran your house like a war zone. The enemy was everywhere. 3. There is an invisible boundary on the 1 train, a spot where uptown fades and white people appear on the train, first in clusters and then all at once. You feel outnumbered, but only because of how they look at you. They hold their bags tight and tell you not to touch their things without prompting. A man checks and rechecks his wallet while staring at your face. You hold your keys in between your fingers and make a fist. You don't know who is more scared of the other. 4. When Carlos was shot, you didn't hear it. You didn't see it. You saw the aftermath, the pool of blood in front of Johnny's fried chicken. The trail ended abruptly where Carlos was loaded into the ambulance. From your window, you hear Juan say, "I'm not paid enough for this shit," as he hoses down the sidewalk. The pink water runs down into the gutter into the sewer. You swear the cement has a maroon sheen to it. You will see the blood stain for years. 5. When you were born, the Bronx was still burning. The fires forced every living thing out of their nooks and crannies. Roaches and rats were underfoot as you grabbed the things you couldn't let burn. The Salvation Army became a permanent fixture on the corner, handing out single-serving cereal boxes and milk cartons to the children. "We have cereal," you wanted to say. Cereal wasn't what you were lacking. You take the boxes, donated clothing, and Ziploc baggie of school supplies anyway, and try not to feel like a charity case. 6. You live in a clean place now. You repeat this to yourself as you watch the raisins in your cereal to make sure they don't sprout legs, make sure the rice isn't rising, and make sure there is nothing and no one else in your bed. Your family pretends the filth never happened. You don't joke about it anymore. Don't find mirth in it. You no longer laugh when you say, "God damn, we used to live like that." 7. The week you moved out of your family's apartment, you found a nest in the bottom of your dresser. The mice pups were clustered together, all wrinkles and mouths. After your initial shock, you watched them sleep. How lucky they are, you thought, not to know they are vermin yet.
Jess, that was awesome. Thank you so much for reading that, and thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm so excited.
I'm excited to have you here. I absolutely love this piece. When I first read it to myself, I swear I got to the last line and I said out loud, "Whoa." I mean, it was such a killer last line.
Thank you. Yeah, this is actually, it's a nonfiction piece, and it's one of the first nonfiction pieces I really wrote. I took a nonfiction class. This was an elective, and I'm one of those people that said, I'm a fiction writer. I would never write about my real life. My mother would kill me. And then I took this class, and it really just, it was with Margaret Renkel, who I adore now. And yeah, she really just opened up this box, I think, that I had locked real tight. And now I'm like, yeah, I guess I'll add nonfiction to the list of genres I write. And now I write nonfiction quite often. But yeah.
I'm always so impressed when a piece this short and concise lands such an emotional punch like that. So as you mentioned, you're a fiction student in the MFA program, but you've also written some poetry and nonfiction. The poetic influence here, I think, is obvious in like the strength of the sentences and how concise the piece is. And I was curious whether this was a fiction or a nonfiction piece and how much your real life was playing into this, because I didn't know when I read it whether it was fiction or nonfiction. So it's interesting to hear that. And I'm curious how much you think about genre when drafting a piece. At what point do you decide an idea should be a poem, an essay, or a fiction piece?
That's a good question. So it's funny because I did my MFA in fiction, and I know we'll get to that later, but I did my MFA in fiction. And I think, I did that for a lot of different reasons we can go into, but I started off as a poet, and I think of myself as someone who thinks in poetry more often than not. So I think a lot of my work starts off sort of being poetic. And then I sort of think, well, is this working and what does the piece want? You know, this piece in particular, it does feel kind of poem-y. I'm sure some people would say it's almost like a prose poem. But I definitely knew that I wanted it to be longer than, just a standard poem. And I didn't want form necessarily to play a big role. Like, I knew I just had something to say and I had this truth. I had this... just this experience of my childhood that I wanted to share. And I didn't want to wrap it in fiction because I felt like it was important for me to get it out. And I just thought this format just fit it. But normally when I sit down for anything, I tend to start with an emotion and an image. What am I trying to get out? What am I trying to say? And then it just takes a lot of playing around for me to land on the right format for it.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, if you look at this piece, I could see how someone would say, oh, this could be a prose poem, right? Because it's written in really short vignettes. And that vignetted structure is something I also really like, because each of those sections you could almost pull out and they could stand alone. But then when they're all put together, it really lands that emotional punch at the end and has that like cohesive feel to it. So I'm curious to hear about your process in writing something like this. Like, when starting out, are you writing those random vignettes, like you said, just thinking about images and a feeling, and then later trying to find a through line between those sections? Or do you already have an idea in mind of what that through line will be when you start writing?
This is when I think everybody will get their pitchforks out. I wrote this piece in about an hour. And I tend to, and it has, it, this is basically what it was like. I didn't do very many changes. I changed some names because I didn't want people coming after me. And I know, it's nonfiction, but I had to use like middle names because I didn't want people coming after me. But I tend to be someone who thinks a lot. and thinks and thinks and thinks, and then I sit down and I write, and it comes out in one go, and that's, and I do revise, obviously. Revising is so much of writing. Rewriting is writing. But for the most part, it comes out in probably a much stronger rough draft than for most other people. And I'm not bragging. I'm just saying, really, if anything, it takes me almost longer because I overthink everything. But for this piece, it really was just me sitting down. This was a piece for a class, so I had a deadline, and I was like, oh, I haven't written anything, damn. I knew I wanted to address this this idea of filth, you know? Like, again, it is a nonfiction piece. I grew up in the South Bronx, right at the tail end of the Bronx's burning era, and this is just how I grew up, and I've always wanted to address it in some way. So yeah, so this piece just came really quickly. Like I said, I knocked it out in like an hour, emailed it to the professor, read it in front of the class because we had to. And the reaction people had made me think, oh, okay, it's not, it's worth probably, you know, keep working on it or keeping it around.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely heard from some writers who just sit down and like the first draft is really rough. They're just getting their ideas out on the page. And for others like you, it sounds like you're almost writing that first draft in your head before you actually put it down on the paper. So, But you mentioned that you still do revision. So I want to hear about that. Like, what does your revision process look like? And what are some of your goals when you sit down to revise a piece?
Yeah, my revision process is particularly thorough, I think, with fiction. And I think with fiction, it sort of has to be to some extent. So when it comes to fiction, I sit down and I think, okay, I usually have emotions there. I usually have good characters. I love writing characters. I love writing dialogue. But then I have to sit down and say, okay, where's my conflict? Mm-hmm. Where's my climax? What is this leading to? And I'm a big person. I don't necessarily follow Freytag's pyramid. But I do think that problem, conflict, and climax are three very interconnected things. Mm-hmm. When you're writing fiction particularly, and I guess to some extent nonfiction, and that's something that I revise for.
So you mentioned earlier rewriting is writing. So how often do you figure out what that conflict or climax is and then have to rewrite sections of the story?
I mean, pretty much every story I've had to do it with, but I haven't, but I find that for me at least, and especially after I think the MFA and I learned some, you know, some skills, it didn't take as much wrestling as it used to. I mean, before, you know, I used to write some stuff and it'd be like, this is an anecdote. I don't know where this is going. this is nothing. And now when I write, I see it there. I see that I have foreshadowed something. I see that I'm getting to something. And it's really just me taking a step back, then going back with fresh eyes and going, oh, here's what I'm trying to say. Here's how I can really blow up this problem and have all these through lines connect. And thankfully, it doesn't take me, you know, too long. But I'm definitely someone that, like, keeps looking at pieces and goes, oh, that sentence could be better. That sentence could have been better. I mean, I just had a piece come out in Transition Magazine, which is awesome. It's a chapter of my novel, so it's super exciting. But I already, like, read it back to myself and was like, oh, yeah, I could have written that sentence differently. You know, it never ends, I think.
Well, you mentioned that novel. I do want to hear a bit about that. It's going on submission this fall, which is really exciting and I'm sure also nerve-wracking. So tell us about that novel. And I'm also curious to hear you talk about how you find your process changing when working on a longer work like that as compared to a piece of short fiction or short nonfiction like the one you read.
Yeah, it's so different. It kind of stressed me out. Just the format of it stressed me out, you know. My novel is called All These Familiar Things, and it is about a community in the South Bronx, really a building. I mean, you know, yeah, they all live together, and a drug raid takes place pretty early in the novel. And it, you know, it sort of fissures the community because everybody has a different perspective on it, on whether it's a good thing, a bad thing. A lot of, you know, basically every man between the age of, you know, 15 15's not even a man, but, you know, every male between the age of 15 to, you know, 50 is rounded up and taken to jail. And if they have even any bit of, you know, weed, drug, anything on them, because of the Rockefeller laws, they get put away for 15 years minimum. So suddenly this community is dealing with all these fathers, you know, grandfathers, brothers, uncles, just disappearing, sons, you know, disappearing from the community. And just, you know, trying to repair itself, and what happens to the people who left when they come back, what happens to the people who stayed, what happens to all the women that now have, are single parents, you know, and have to work. And, you know, it's really just a novel about community. I call it my love letter to the Bronx, because the South Bronx might as well be a character, you know. I loved growing up in the South Bronx. I know it has this reputation, but for me, that's still home. And I, you know, I feel like I tried to imbue like every page of that manuscript with how rich the community is. It's not just this dangerous place. It's not just this dirty place. It's, you know, it's a place. It's a home for a lot of people. And yeah, so I think that's what I tried to capture in my novel. The revision process was interesting. It's a polyphonic novel, meaning that, you know, different chapters are in different voices, different characters' voices. Mm-hmm. So in that instance, it felt a bit like writing several short stories, because I was able to sort of, you know, jump in and out of different perspectives and different happenings. And that's why I think I was able to publish one almost as a standalone in transition, right? But at the same time, I knew that I had this overall arc, this overall plot of this drug raid and what happens to these people. And then, of course, the drug raid, because it happens early on, that's not actually my climax. I won't spoil the climax because I want people to buy the book, but I did have to then sit down and say, okay, so what happens? What is the conflict here besides just the drug raid? Because the drug raid has happened at this point. What is the conflict? What does my protagonist want? What is keeping her from her want? And how does it all come to a head? What decision does she come to that forms the climax? And figuring that out took me a bit of wrestling. I was still wrestling with it like all summer even, you know, where I was just like doing revisions and I was like, is this good enough? What am I, you know? So that presents us challenges, because it wasn't just like one thread or like 20 pages of arc I had to deal with. It's, you know, it's 300, you know? Right. So. Even just the like physical aspect of printing it all out and putting it all up. I'm used to doing that with poems. I'm used to doing that with short stories. Putting up 300 pages on your walls, I don't pay that much rent to have for all those pages, you know? So it was interesting, to say the least.
Well, it's clear that your upbringing in the Bronx has had some influence on this novel that you're working on. You also told me that coming from a Caribbean oral storytelling tradition has made your work stronger. Can you tell us a bit about that Caribbean oral tradition and the ways you see it affecting and strengthening your work?
Yeah, I mean, I was raised by my grandparents. I mean, my mom and my dad were around, but my mom worked. My dad had issues. But so I was raised by my grandparents, and they're both from Puerto Rico. And, you know, storytelling was just such a big thing. And I don't even mean like storytelling, like good night stories. I just mean we were constantly communicating, constantly talking, constantly coming up with like, you know, almost like little skits of people. We would people watch all the time. I used to, you know, come home from school with my grandpa. He would walk me home from school. And then we'd used to just hang out on the stoop and people watch and come up with, you know, stories about people. And my, you know, my grandparents never went to school. And I mean, no school. I mean, not grade school, not, you know, and they didn't speak English. So everything was oral, you know. And, you know, there's these songs in Puerto Rico, Plena and Bomba, and they're stories. They're stories told to music and call and answer response. And they actually come from, you know, African, you know, slave traditional music, because, you know, slave trade, Caribbean, it's all there. So, you know, I just grew up with this idea of story being song, of being fun, of being joyous, of being something that you do as a community. And yeah, I think that had a big impact on my writing and how I like to tell stories and just how much character I put into my work, how much my characters interact, how strong my dialogue is. And at least that's what I've been told, that my dialogue is strong. And I do love writing dialogue, I'm not going to lie. Someone told me once, maybe you should consider being a playwright. I'm like, I can't add another genre right now. let me deal with these three first. Let me get my novel out, and then we'll see, you know. But yeah, that upbringing, you know, and my grandparents just had such a huge influence on me as a, just as an artist in general.
Do you still find yourself people watching and making up stories? Do you get ideas for stories that way?
Absolutely. Oh, I love, there's nothing, there's this joke by Lewis Black where he says that he overheard someone said, if it wasn't for my horse, I would have never finished that semester in school. And that it almost gave him an aneurysm because he couldn't figure out how that worked. You know, and my mom and I reference that joke all the time, but I love moments like that. Like, I'll be walking in the supermarket and I'll hear a line and I'm like, what could that possibly mean? And I come up with all these stories, you know, and some of them will absolutely make it into a short story or a flash or, you know, I think it's fun. I think it's a fun, even if it doesn't, you know, not everything has to be published or sent out. Even if it's just to, you know, do a writing exercise that day. You know, I try to write something at least small every day. It's just fun.
All right. So we've got the Bronx, big influence on you. We've got that Caribbean oral tradition. You also told me before the interview that being a disabled writer has greatly influenced your work. And this is something I don't hear people talk about much. So I'd love to hear your perspective on this and hear about your experience. In what ways do you see this impacting your work?
I mean, just in a lot of different ways. I think, you know, I mean, obviously there's the physical ones, right? I'm both, you know, neurodivergent and physically disabled. I use a wheelchair, a mobility scooter, cane, depending on how far I have to go, you know, each of these things. So, you know, there's the physical aspect of being a writer who has those limitations, right? Everything that I do is digital, you know, all my books that I read are Kindles just because it's easier for me to carry around, things like that. You know, my writing, I honestly wrote probably a good 80% of my novel on my phone because it's just easier for me to write on my phone. It's easier for me to have that, just to have my arms in that position, you know, because I have some nerve damage. You know, it's also led to a bigger community for me because I am president of the Disabled and Deaf Writers Caucus, and it's opened up just meeting so many different people and having support for the things that we run into. And because of that community that I'm now a part of, and there are a lot of disabled writers, I think people don't realize how many of us there are, but even the caucus alone, I think, has 300 members or something. And that's really not, you know, even half of all the people, you know, that could possibly join. So I've been introduced to so much work, beautiful, wonderful, talented work from these writers, who I feel often are, you know, they're marginalized for different reasons. You know, sometimes even something as simple as, for the longest time, submittable wasn't accessible, believe it or not, you know, things like that. So it's just changed the way I approach writing, and it changed the way I think about the writing community. I mean, I've been disabled for a long time, so I can't do like a before or after comparison. I was, you know, disabled when I started calling myself a writer, but yeah, I think my experiences are probably different from my peers. And even just the way we, you know, get to experience the writing community. I know this is going to sound horrible, but in some ways, COVID made me feel like even more part of the writing community because everything was online. And I was like, oh, I can go to all these readings. I can go to all these workshops, you know. I can attend these conferences that we couldn't attend before. And I think a lot of disabled people felt like that. Of course, that was weighed by the fact that COVID was obviously dangerous for everybody, even right. more dangerous when you're disabled. So obviously it's not like I wish for COVID.
Right.
but at the same time, there are certain things that I wish we would keep And, you know, as we push towards quote unquote normal or post-pandemic normalcy, if you will, that's something that I actually wish would stay. I wish that we had the option to zoom into more readings or stream readings, however you want to do it, stream more workshops. Because I think, you know, there's so many people for whom normal never really worked.
For anyone who doesn't know about the Disabled and Deaf Writers Caucus, could you tell us a bit about it and how you got involved?
Yeah, so the Disabled and Deaf Writers Caucus was started by a few people. Jennifer Marie Bartlett was one of them. It was started, I want to say back in like 2010 or something like that. So it's been around for probably not as long as it should have been, but it's been around for a while. And it's under the, you know, auspices of AWP, which is the Association of Writing and Writing Writers and Writing Programs. So there are several caucuses within AWP, like LGBTQ, Latino caucus, Black Writers Caucus, different things. And there wasn't a disabled one for a long time. So it was created. And, you know, part of its, well, I don't want to say its job, but part of its responsibilities or what it tries to do is to make sure, one, that the annual conference is accessible, and two, just to make sure that, you know, we support each other within the literary community. You know, disabled writers support each other, and, you know, we find ways to make sure that we're being represented, make sure that we're being acknowledged and being brought in as part of the overall literary community. You know, for the longest time, AWP had a huge problem with accessibility. It was very hard to attend if you were disabled in almost any way. You know, there were physical barriers. There were, you know, issues if you were deaf or hard of hearing, you know, issues if you were neurodivergent. They just, you know, they dropped the ball for a couple of years. I will say they've been doing a lot better now. And the conference has, you know, done things like made sure that there's, you know, push door, you know, pedals on all the doors, so they're automatic. You know, they take down all the cords now. You know, they provide captions and ASL interpreters at all the panels and, you know, things like that. So they've gotten a lot better. And anyone, you know, anyone who identifies as a disabled writer is free to join the caucus. You can Google us. We'd love to have you. And, you know, ultimately we would just, yeah, help you find community, advocate for your needs, and, you know, hopefully get more of us out there, get more of us published and out in the world, because, you know, we're pretty badass.
You definitely are. I 100% agree. All right, so we have to talk about your experience in the MFA at Vanderbilt, but before we do, I want to talk about your path to the MFA. You actually started a different program, left that program, and then waited about 3 years before attending Vandy. So what motivated your decision to leave that previous school and take some time off before choosing a new program?
Yeah, I'm going to name drop the program and say that it was Brooklyn College, because I just want to go on the record and say that I love Brooklyn. I have nothing against Brooklyn. I still on draft say, hey, if you're a New Yorker, you want a good MFA program, add them to your list. Genuinely great people, great writers, great faculty. It just wasn't the right place for me. And I think that's such an important thing to talk about. Because sometimes, you know, getting into an MFA program feels like such a struggle, such a almost like a crapshoot, right? Like it's so difficult to do that when you get into a program, it could feel like, oh, I struck gold. I'm lucky. I need to sit this out and, you know, grit my teeth and go through it no matter what, because I will never have this chance again. I completely understand that feeling, and I certainly had it for a little while. But I knew that Brooklyn just wasn't right for me. And then I also had some medical issues pop up. And all of that combined with the fact that it was in New York City. And again, I'm a New Yorker, but New York rent is not cute. I just decided the best thing for my writing, for me and my writing, would be to take a break. You know, I took a medical leave from the program. I went to my mom's home in Florida, did that for a while. And I worked on my novel a bit, but it was a little meandering. It was more like, I have some ideas, let me figure it out. I don't think I even had the main plot point yet. It was just kind of noodling with writing. And I think about 2 years after that, I decided, you know what? I definitely want to do my MFA. I definitely want to write. I know it's what I need to kick my butt and let me, you know, write this manuscript. But I don't think Brooklyn is the right place for me. And the first time I had applied to MFA programs, I didn't cast a wide net. I wanted to stay in New York, so I basically only applied to some of the New York schools. I don't think I even applied to NYU at the time. So yeah, I cast a very, very small net. And I think there was a part of me that always kind of kicked myself for it. Because I was like, well, what if I had tried, you know? So the second time I applied, I cast a much wider net. Definitely only applied to schools I would go to. So like, I didn't apply to Michigan because I was like, I can't do that cold. I'm sorry, Michigan. I love you. Not for me. You know, but I applied to schools that I knew I would go, I wanted to go to. Vanderbilt was top of my list for a lot of reasons we can get into. But yeah, I applied. I had a very successful season. I applied to 11 schools, and I think I only got rejected from 3 of them. So I had some choices to make, and Vanderbilt, again, was my first choice. So it was hard to let go of some other schools because they were lovely. But yeah, Vanderbilt, I think, was always going to win the battle.
Well, let's talk about Vanderbilt's program. It's a 3-year fully funded MFA in creative writing with tracks in fiction and poetry. It's been a part of the English department there for like 100 years, which is kind of amazing. Yeah. They only accept 6 students each year, so admission is highly competitive. So you said it was at the top of your list. What was it that eventually drew you to Vanderbilt? I know accessibility was a huge factor. We've talked about this a little bit.
Yeah. Accessibility was huge. And I think, so I'm going to preface this by saying no school is perfect. And I'm not going to say that Vanderbilt did not have accessibility problems. It did. However, sometimes the tone with which people address, you know, accessibility issues matters just as much as the solutions. And, you know, as I said, I got into, you know, several schools and I emailed all of them basically the same, like, kind of boilerplate, hey, I'm disabled, what are we going to do, sort of email. And I got everything back from, you know, well, yeah, we'll move your classes to, like, what basically equated to, like, a shrug, if you could shrug in an email, you know. Meanwhile, Vanderbilt said, you know, I'm going to be honest. The director at the time said, I'm going to be honest. I don't have all the answers, but we can find them. And here's what I do know. And she ended up sending me something like a 5-page email full of maps and links and just all these details, you know, very upfront with what she didn't know yet. But just that tone mattered to me because it meant, okay, but they're trying. Okay, but they won't treat it like it's my problem, you know? So that won me over. That was the first thing. The second thing is, realistically, you know, the stipend is bomb. let's be honest, money is important. You know, right now, I believe their stipend is something like $35,000 a year. And that covers, you know, they also have health insurance and a moving stipend on top of that, your first semester. And Vanderbilt in general, even outside of the MFA department, Vanderbilt in general is very generous with its money. My last year there, I had to fly home to Florida. Well, I say home because that's where my mom is. Home is where mom is now, even though I'm a New Yorker. I had to fly to Florida, evacuate my mother for Hurricane Ian. We drove to the middle of the state, stayed in a hotel with our 7 pets, drove back. Then I flew back to Nashville. It was a lot. And I, you know, I emailed someone at the, like, they have this, like, you know, student cares office. And I said, hey, I had to do all this. Is there some money for, like, I know you have, like, a student hardship fund. Yeah. What can I do? And they were like, oh, just send us all the receipts. And they paid for all of it.
Wow.
Every cent of that evacuation madness. And they paid for, like, my wheelchair rental. One time my wheelchair broke. And, you know, things like that. So I needed that sort of financial stability. I mean, I just read Pests. You know, I grew up super poor. Yeah. So I needed that financial stability in my life. And it really did make a huge difference. It's probably the most financially stable I've ever been. And it really, you know, made a huge difference in even my family's life, to be honest. But also, the fact that it's such a small program, you get really individualized, you know, attention.
Mm-hmm.
And Vanderbilt also, and I don't know how they do it, I'm sure there's some magic to it, they do a really good job of picking people, not just for their talent, but I think people that honestly jive well together. Like, none of us were competitive. None of us were, like, you know, snarky with each other or anything like that. Like, we all genuinely became friends, even the year above us and the year below us. And, you know, people hung out all the time, you know, babysat each other's kids, babysat each other's dogs. Like, it was just a really nice community. You know, we would go over to, like, the director's house for, like, you know, fancy charcuterie boards, you know, like, it was a really nice, tight-knit community. And I think I was really craving that at that point.
Well, I want to talk more about the stipend, and I want to talk more about the community. But first, I want to go back to something you said earlier, which was that no school is perfect when it comes to accessibility.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to hear what advice you have for disabled applicants who might be listening. What things should they look for, and what questions should they ask?
Oh, absolutely. That's a good question. I think the number one thing that I'm going to say just right off the bat is advocate for yourself. Advocate for yourself. Advocate for yourself. It's so easy to feel, and it could be internalized or even external, you know, different forces could just make you feel like what you're asking for is too much.
Mm.
And I say, like, screw that. you are literally asking to be able to access the same education everyone else in that program is getting. That is your right. And you should never be ashamed or concerned or hesitant about asking for your rights, you know? So that's the first thing. Whatever you need, and even if it seems pie in the sky, ask. The worst thing they could say is no. And if they're legally obligated, they can't say no. So, but I think, you know, questions to ask are definitely, you know, have you had other disabled students? How have you approached it? If I cannot get into a classroom, you know, what are the options? If I can't get into the events, that's a big one. What are the options? You know, what does social life look like there? Is it malleable? And, you know, look at not just the location of something, but also think about how you would move in the space. Think about, you know, do you need an airport nearby? I did. I don't drive. So the idea of being 2 hours away from an airport gave me hives, you know? I was like, I'm not going to Uber somewhere for 2 hours. So, you know, does that matter to you? And of course, there are different disabilities. So for some people, that's not even a concern. So, but, you know, does that matter to you? Do you need to be in a city or a space where, you know, they're more likely to have elevators and lifts? Because let me tell you, some places do not. Some places, the buildings are so old, you are stuck in, you know, it stoops everywhere. You know, do you need... Yeah, do you need trees? Do you need water nearby? All of that's important for mental health, and I think that's accessibility too. And just ask other students and say, well, what has been, and, you know, what has it been like for you? And you know, what do I need to look out for? What do I need to prepare myself for? And that's helpful. But I think, you know, I almost say, because so much is covered under the ADA, definitely, you know, apply to all the places that interest you. And to some extent, you know, once you get into a program, the ball is in their court. And make sure it's in their court. Put it in their court.
Mm-hmm.
Smack them in the face with the ball if you have to. you know, if you get into a school and you really want to attend, they have to make it work. You know, don't be afraid to push for that.
Great advice. All right, so let's talk about that stipend. As you mentioned, it's a pretty generous package that they offer: full tuition, remission, health insurance, and according to the website, a stipend of $34,000 a year. Sometimes those go up a little bit each year, so maybe it's $35,000 now, as you said. In exchange for that stipend, it appears that students teach. What kinds of classes and workload can incoming students expect when teaching at Vandy?
The workload is, at least in my opinion, pretty light. So your first year, you don't teach at all. Your second year, you teach one semester. Your third year, you do not take any classes yourself. It's just a fellowship year. You're just doing your thesis. But you either teach both semesters, or you work for the department one semester and teach the second semester, or you work at something called the Curb Center and do almost like arts management. So you wouldn't teach at all. You'd just be working there. So, you know, you could potentially go all 3 years only teaching one semester. Or you could go 3 years and teach three semesters. But I think three semesters is the max you teach. So for me, I thought that was really generous, really lovely. And you only teach one class per semester, I mean. So, like, you know, and you do get a semester long pedagogy class your first year. So you're not teaching and taking pedagogy at the same time, which so many schools do, which just really baffles me. But that's another topic. So, you know, you do get that sort of, you know, teaching, you know, support, and you get a teaching mentor as well. Someone who during your first semester of teaching, you can email or meet with and say, hey, I'm having a student doing this. How do you handle it? Or, you know, so on and so forth. So you are extremely supported. Your writing time is very much protected. And when you do teach, it is creative writing and you are the instructor of record. So you can do whatever you want. I taught sci-fi. I didn't care. You know, my students wanted sci-fi. I brought sci-fi into the class. Let's do it. Let's get weird. you know, it was so much fun, honestly. So, yeah, I really enjoyed teaching at Vanderbilt. I enjoyed the students. I enjoyed how they just sort of how they structured the whole thing. It was a lot of fun.
I'm also curious to hear you talk a bit about the community, not just at Vanderbilt, but in Nashville. One thing you told me before the interview was that despite Tennessee having a certain reputation, you felt really supported as a writer and a trans queer person. How has the community been for you?
Yeah, Nashville was pretty great. I mean, again, Tennessee has its issues. Tennessee has its, you know, stereotypes, reputation. And I'm not going to lie, there were certainly, I didn't venture too far out from Nashville. But Vanderbilt itself, you know, has a trans health center, has a lot of, you know, queer programming, queer trans, you know, events and support. Lydia Conklin now teaches in the MFA program, and they are non-binary. You know, so the program itself, super supportive, super queer, super trans. And Nashville as a whole, yeah, it's, you know, we actually have a local bookstore called Parnassus, and it's actually run by Ann Patchett, the writer. So, I mean, how much more literary can you get? There are a lot of events there, like on a, you know, bi-weekly basis, and such a huge part of the community. There's also this gigantic youth bookstore. They sell other things too, but it's mostly youth books, called McKay's, which takes up like a whole block. And it is like an experience. It's not a store. It's an experience. You know, you go to McKay's with, you know, $20 and you come out just happy, just joyful. Just so many books, so many things. And yeah, and there are just a lot of different events, just for the arts in general. Obviously, literary writing and all that, but it's Nashville, so songwriting, music is huge there, as you can imagine. Taylor Swift still pops up there every once in a while at the Bluebird Cafe, you know? So songwriting and music is huge, too. And if that's something you're interested in, it's a great community for that as well. So, yeah, I felt just very, very comfortable there as an artist, as a queer artist, as, you know, a Latina artist. Yeah, it was a lot cooler than I expected it to be. I had always kind of wanted to go to Nashville, even before, like, Vanderbilt, even before I wanted to write. I just thought it sounded like a cool city, and it actually really is. I really enjoyed living there.
Well, I also want to make sure that we take some time to talk about MFA Draft, the Facebook group that you've been adminning for almost 7 years now. For anyone who doesn't know, what is that group and how does it support prospective MFA students?
Sure. So MFA Draft is a Facebook group. It started in 2010, I believe. And I have to, you know, give it up to like Kenzie Allen, who's one of the OGs of the group and still is one of the admins, and she's amazing. She's a poet, an indigenous poet, gotta shout her out. She's the best. So it's a Facebook group in which prospective MFA students, you know, applicants, can join and just basically discuss the process. You know, it has obviously newbies, people who are applying, but it also has what we call veterans. Those are people who have applied and attended, are currently attended or alumni of MFA programs. So, you know, they know the in and outs. Obviously, I'm a veteran. So I've been in the game for so long because I became an admin in 2017. So I've seen years and years and years of MFA applicants, MFA problems, MFA issues, everything that could possibly come up during an application cycle. I have seen it. I have seen it all. I've seen lost letters of recommendation. I've seen, you know, whoops emails where someone got accepted but wasn't supposed to be. Someone got rejected but wasn't supposed to be. I got the Iowa never called me, but I got a letter and they did admit me after all. You know, I've seen it all, Jared. And yeah, it's just a space to really just make the process transparent, because it really isn't. Even if you're an academic, it's such a different process from any other grad school program. I would say even from other MFA programs, because I have friends who are visual artists. And it's a different ball of wax. And especially if you aren't an academic, it's even worse. You know, you see the words like statement of purpose and you're like, what? What am I supposed to be writing? What do these schools want? And it's just a process that's just so confusing. And that's really the goal, I think, of Draft, to, you know, make it a more transparent process, really explain what it is that, you know, these schools want for you for the most part, and really just give you community. The people that I met the first time I applied to MFA, so when I went to Brooklyn, are people that I still talk to literally every day of my life. So they have become my writing circle. You know, there's like a group of like 20 of us who became close. And yeah, we're now a writing circle, and we're all, you know, working together, and we're all reading each other's work, and we're all getting, you know, agents and book deals now because we've hit that level of our career. And it's so exciting and it's so fascinating. And that's, I think, one of the things that, you know, Draft also offers. You know, you get this built-in community of people who are not only writers, but have the same goals as you, because I do think that's important. So they have the same goals as you, and you go through your careers together. And that's really nice. I'm not going to lie. That's just wonderful. It's just such a nice feeling to see your friends succeed and then for you to kind of follow along, because you learn from them. You learn from their success, you know? So yeah, I love Draft. I will always, you know, cape for Draft. We have a rule that admins of MFA programs aren't allowed in the group. Like if you're a teacher at an MFA program, or, you know, faculty, or obviously, like, you know, any kind of admin position, it's purely for applicants and people who have been through it, because we want to keep it a safe space. So there's a little part of me that hopes that I never become like MFA faculty, because I would hate to be kicked out of the group, you know, even though I would understand. But yeah, we definitely try to keep it a safe space. And I think it's just special.
Yeah, I would absolutely second that it's a really great community. And one thing that always stands out to me every year when the new MFA draft page is made, the community continues to be incredibly positive and supportive. There are no bad questions that you can ask. You don't have to feel embarrassed to go on there and just put down a question that you might think is really basic. The veterans are meeting you where you are, and it's this really positive, supportive place, which was something that I really loved when I was applying to MFA programs.
Yeah, like shout out to our veterans. I can't name them all and it changes every year, but like seriously, like shout out to the people who get into a program and then come back and give back. Hey, here's what I learned when I was going through this, because the community would be nothing without them. It would just be all of us guessing, guessing right at what these schools want, you know? For people to come back and say, hey, here's what worked, or don't worry, I went through this too, or, oh God, I totally had 8 typos, you're fine. you know, it's so invaluable. I'm so grateful to them.
All right. Well, before we go, I want to give you the last word. What is one way in which the MFA experience was different, for better or for worse, from your expectations when applying?
one way that it was different, and I don't know if it's better or worse, but just one way that it was different is if you're someone who's extremely career-minded, meaning that you go into a program saying, I want an agent and I want a book by the time I graduate, depending on the program, they might tell you, hey, just slow down and focus on your writing. And that's not a bad answer. Like, by all means, you should focus on your writing and growing your skills. What I will say, though, is that if you're someone who knows, no, this is my career, I want these things, I'm going to go after these things, don't be afraid to do so. You know, again, draft is really good for finding people who are on your level, so to speak. And if you know that's something that you want, yeah, make friends that want that too, and have, you know, submission circles, you know, get on Zoom, even if it's on mute, and, you know, submit to places together, query agents together. Don't be afraid to, you know, chase that professionalism, if you will, because ultimately we all want to be writers. At, you know, at the level of it, hopefully paying at least some of our bills, at least pay my cable bill, you know?
Well, Jess, you are an absolute rock star. This has been so much fun talking to you. Thank you so much for coming by. And I should mention that you're starting a PhD in creative writing at the University of Cincinnati right now, this fall. Good luck with that. I know you're going to do amazing. And I hope I get to talk to you again sometime really soon.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was awesome. I'm such a fan of the podcast and everything you do. So this was awesome. Thank you so much.